This is part one of a cast on clicker training. If you have a pet and you wish to train it, or you're a guide dog owner, you'll find my comments interesting. But if you are not a pet person, then skip this cast, because it's all about how to have more bonding with those furry critters in our life. First, some background. You should know that I don't have enough vision to ever monitor what my pets are up to, so I'm doing this, as they say, from the blindness perspective. Second, I'm a passionate guide dog user, and though I wasn't always one, I happily used a cane in my 20s. In fact, I loved dogs so much I was sure I'd make a terrible guide dog handler because I would have trouble being strict enough. Well, I'm now almost 50, and I'm working my fourth guide dog. I've also, over my life, adopted and trained about 10 shelter dogs. I've also had cats, guinea pigs, cockatiels, rabbits, and hamsters. So having animals and training them to behave the way I like is not new. But for me, clicker training and its positive approach is very new, and it's very, very exciting. Third, I need to emphasize that I am not an expert. There are lots of professionals and experts out there. I am just a novice. Also, I don't want to become a dog trainer. I just want to publicize this technique. I want to handle my own personal dogs well. If you are looking for experts or advice to help you, I'll have resources at the end of this chat, but I am not trying to give you advice. I'm not qualified to do it. I am not trying to tell you how to handle your dog. I am trying to make you aware of this new and wonderful method and how it really works. My cast is structured like this. First, I'll tell you how clicker training works, what it is. I'll next describe a few typical beginning sessions and then a few advanced sessions. And with both of these, I'll have adaptations for a blind person. Last, I'll contrast clicker methods with more traditional training. And throughout this whole cast, I'll cover some misconceptions because dispelling myths about this wonderful method is so important for me. I'm reading this whole cast, and it's going to be very formal so we can keep the pace picked up and I can get everything covered. But in part two, we'll be totally informal. We'll do some actual clicker training with my very own guide dog, Boston. He's a golden retriever, age 5, and very exuberant and very goofy. He will not always do things properly, and you'll get to see how I handle that. And if this clicker training session interests people, I'll be reading the list, well, to see if it does interest people. We can do a part three and answer questions there. So first we're going to start with the basics. The idea of clicker training, it's very simple. You show a dog a behavior you want, and then you click when he gets it right. Clicking him involves making a short, sharp sound, and following that up with a treat. How do you click? Most people use a clicker. It's a mechanical plastic thing that traces its ancestry back to those dime store toys that children clicked to make noise. Today, pet stores all sell clickers, and you can buy them from hundreds of vendors on the net. When scientists started with clicker training, however, they actually did buy the little novelty toys in variety stores. In a pinch, you can click a pen, opening or closing it, or you can click a metal tape measure, opening or closing it, or even make a tongue click. Commercial clickers are considered best, though. This is because the sound is very fast and it's very sharp. Scientists believe that it triggers the amygdala directly. This is a portion of the brainstem that controls activities below the conscious level. That's why the dog can respond so quickly to a click. Now, you're probably asking what's wrong with praise. Nothing is wrong with praise. Clicker trainers praise their dogs. But praise is not considered precise enough to show the dog exactly what you want to do. Praise works, of course, but there are two problems with it as a reinforcer. Results are faster with a clicker, and they're more consistent because of the amygdala. You can use only praise. In fact, for years, I used only praise. And there is, as I said, nothing wrong with it. But But it has yet another problem. Many trainers now believe that praise merely functions as a cue to the dog that a correction is not forthcoming. So it's a safety cue, a no punishment this time cue, rather than an indicator that the dog has got something right. And this moves us into one of the basic philosophies behind clicker training. This is the idea that a dog is free to experiment, to discover for himself what behavior you want. Dogs that are corrected, these trainers believe, are less and less likely to experiment. They lose initiative. They learn that they must passively wait to be told what to do. If you are a traditional trainer, you probably already have your hackles up. You can't imagine abandoning correction or reducing praise. But listen to me without arguing yet, and remember, I'll be working hard to dispel common myths. To research and learn about anything new, you must have an open mind. So don't crowd it closed yet with rebuttals. I said the method is simple, click and treat. A treat needs to be something small. You give it to the dog quickly. Small so you won't fatten up a dog, and small so he can devour it in one gulp and be ready for the next behavior. A treat is anything you and your dog like. I like stuff that isn't perishable, doesn't smell, isn't many calories, isn't expensive. He likes anything that tastes good, but some animals are much more finicky. People treat the dogs with food, dog food that is, or people food, tiny pieces of chicken or cheese or hot dog or a lick of peanut butter. They even use crazy things like carrots and slices of orange. Boston, my dog, loves oranges. They aren't many calories, which is good, but their downside is that they're messy. So we treat with oranges at the park, and we try to use dog kibble when we're inside. Again, you ask, well, what's wrong with praise? And the reason treats are preferred to praise is that brainstem thing again. A dog can be taught to enjoy praise, but it isn't, as the behaviorists say, a primary reinforcer. Food, on the other hand, is something that instinctively a pet wants. You can clicker train a guinea pig with cabbage. Try using praise on a guinea pig, and you'll quickly see why praise is not a primary reinforcer. And you can use millet to train a cockatiel to jump from one hand to another. But though these little birds enjoy being spoken to, it's unlikely praise will ever have significance for them the way it can work with a dog. Dogs don't have too much trouble learning that praise is a reinforcer, a secondary reinforcer, albeit, but a reinforcer. It is true that the click is also a secondary reinforcer, but that's why most trainers advise you that it should always be paired with a treat. For me, I do always treat after a click, but I often praise once a behavior is learned, and don't click for every correct behavior. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with praise. The treat thing is just primarily used for teaching. Once an animal knows what you want, you don't have to tote around a bushel of doggy crackers. Here's an example. I taught Boston that when I snap my fingers in front of me, he's to back his butt in between my knees and sit. His tail is between my heels, his shoulders are above my knees, and his head is facing away from me. This is what many guide dog users call the bus sit, because it's a convenient position for the dog to assume on transit, so it's out of the aisle as much as possible. But most of us guide dog handlers have to manhandle our dog into that bus sit position. Well, for me, that got really old when my hands were full, say with packages. Now I snap, and Boston shoves my knees apart to sit between my legs without me having to touch him at all. When he does this, he gets praise 100% of the time. He can trust that he'll always get that praise. If I'm talking to someone, praise is just a snuggle and an ear scratching, but he's always going to get some acknowledgement that he obeyed me. He gets a treat only about 5% of the time, and often less. But when I was training him to respond to my finger snap, he got that treat 100% of the time. Why? Because that's how you communicate with a dog. You're saying, yep, you got it right, buddy. That's what I wanted. You've got to remember that for us, Language is closer to being a primary reinforcer than it is for dogs. So my swim coach can use praise to tell me when I have the correct arm position as I master a new stroke. But I'm really motivated to improve my form when I swim, and I'm probably more motivated to improve my form than my coach is. But my dog may not be very motivated to improve his form when I want him to sit. You see, for a dog to master a new behavior, he needs a primary reinforcer as motivation. So, treats aren't used to spoil the dog. They are simply a communication tool, a motivator that speaks to the dog's brain at its very core. Let's talk about another beginning session so you can see the principle in action. Let's say you want your dog to periodically look at you throughout the day in order to focus on you to receive instruction. A distracted dog is not paying attention to you clearly. You need that animal to pay attention in order to have learning occur. So the sighted trainer simply waits for the dog to look at him, and then he clicks and treats. He does this over and over again until the dog learns two things. First, he learns that the clicker means a treat, and second, he learns that looking at his master brings him good surprises. Scientists would say that the dog has been trained to see the clicker as a secondary reinforcer. Trainers call this charging the clicker. Now, a blind trainer can't tell if the dog is looking at him, but there's really no problem. You have to train the dog to make physical contact. So I started with Boston. I clicked him each time he touched me. After a while, I always petted him when he touched me, but I clicked only if, in reaching down to feel his big, soft, floppy ears, I could tell he was looking at me. Pretty soon, I had a dog that my sighted husband and my sighted college students assures me spends a lot of time staring at me intently. And let me talk a little about luring, which is also a technique to show a dog what you want. Luring is often used together with clicker training, and sometimes it takes the place of clicker training. Another concrete example, again with Boston. In our home, we invite him up on the bed to pet and to snuggle, but we don't want him on our bed when we go to sleep. We want him on the quilt, on the cedar chest, at the foot of our bed. To properly position Boston, I first was manhandling him, but I really wanted to find a way to communicate my needs in a loving and humane manner. So I held a treat in my fist and raised it above the cedar chest. Boston happily jumped up there and followed the treat around with his nose. I held it higher and higher, causing him to back up. This caused his feet and his butt to go back far enough that he would sit. Then I moved the treat around a bit, so he repeatedly stood and sat, backing up all the while. Finally, his feet and butt had him sitting at the far edge of the cedar chest. I slowly lowered the treat until my fist was between his legs. He was laying down, nose on paws. This was the desired position, so I clicked, opened my fist, and gave him the treat. If you are thinking that this won't work with your dog, well, you're probably right. I'm oversimplifying to make the explanation of the luring techniques clear. Books and websites can guide you in the specifications of how to perform luring and clicker training, for that matter, properly. There's one other beginner session I'd like to describe, the concept of doggy zen. Many dogs will nab your fist with a treat inside. They'll make the whole session unpleasant. Dogs need to learn that barking, pawing, slurping, and biting will not give them a treat. So you show them a fist with a treat, and when they start nabbing it, you ignore them. When they stop nabbing it, you open your hand and click while you're treating them. They learn that other behaviors can coerce you to click, but not nabbing the hand holding the goodies. I had read about targeting, so I personally adapted both doggy zen and targeting to teach Boston both things with one technique. So let's explain targeting first. You use a target to send a dog to where you want. For example, a quadriplegic may want to send a dog across the room to retrieve his glasses that were left on a table. If the dog has learned targeting, the quadriplegic can simply point a stick at those glasses and show the dog what to retrieve. Or a handler might wish to teach a dog a complex move in agility. So, using a target stick, she guides the dog through the movements. The dog follows the stick with his nose just as Boston followed my fist on the cedar chest. I modified this technique by teaching Boston to touch my closed fist with his nose. I started out by showing him two fists, the right fist enclosing a treat, and the left fist had no treat. He pawed and slurped and nibbled at the right-hand fist with the treat. I waited quietly. Finally, in desperation, he touched his nose to my left fist. I promptly opened the right hand and clicked him. After several repetitions, he immediately nuzzled the non-treat hand. I taught him that sometimes the left hand held the treat, and sometimes the right, but either way, he didn't get it by pawing and licking. I began to add the cue touch, moving the non-treat hand away. Now, touch is a game for us. When I want him to focus on me, I whip out a fist, move it around wildly, and say, "Touch, touch." He chases my fist, often jumping in the air to plant a wet kiss on it. I also use touch for more serious and calmer operations, like maneuvering him under a restaurant table or getting him to heel behind me single file. Targeting is great for moving a dog about without having to pull and push him where you want him to go. And Doggy Zen teaches another important lesson, the idea that he can experiment, and the only consequences are that no reward is forthcoming. It teaches the dog that you are the god of all treats, but that you are a benevolent god. This concept is opposite of the learned helplessness we force on dogs with correction. With correction, we teach that we're the boss, but the dog has fewer ways to take control. With clicking, we still teach that we are the source of all good things, but the dog is free to figure out what makes us click, so to speak. You might wonder how Boston keeps from getting confused, because sometimes I lure him with a treat hand, and sometimes I ask him to touch a non-treat hand. But since he's not getting corrections, there's no penalty for guessing wrong. This is the beauty of clicker training. The dog is free to experiment and learn subtleties. If he sees me getting out treats and pulling out a clicker, he knows we're learning something new or practicing something he doesn't really know well yet. But if, on the other hand, I wave my fist around and say touch, he knows he's not supposed to be looking for a treat or doing something new. He occasionally will get a treat nevertheless for touch, but it's no longer necessary. As I said before, you regularly don't treat for behaviors the dog's already mastered. It's important to tune into your dog to figure out what gives him pleasure. Once he knows a behavior, you can use a variety of rewards to keep him motivated. Boston loves novelty and surprise. A few days ago, when he located a garbage can I asked him to find, I didn't click or treat, but instead I pulled out a tiny squeaky toy with a long furry tail, and I wiggled it above his head. He went wild trying to chase it and later tugging on it. The surprise was the reward. Anything your dog likes to do is self-reinforcing. Digging, jumping, barking, sniffing, all those undesirable behaviors can be rechanneled into reward. Boston likes to go outside to bark, so we take bark breaks where we both go outside and we just kind of bark at each other. It's silly, but it works. You have already seen how to use luring to teach a dog to lay down, but there's another way. It's called shaping. Suppose you have adopted a young dog from a shelter. I remember Mocha, a sweet 8-month-old border collie mix. He was a bundle of energy. I'd adopt him, and I'm sure he was given up for adoption because he just never sat still. I took Mocha with me every time I had to use the bathroom. This was because without training, poor Mocha couldn't be left unsupervised. He was just too wild and out of control. Now, the bathroom is a very boring little room. Eventually, Mocha would get really bored in the boring little bathroom. He'd stop dashing frantically about, and he would lie down. As soon as this happened, he'd get a treat. No luring was necessary, for Mocha was way too high energy to have noticed a fist with a treat in it anyway. He had been banished to a backyard, and Unlike a guide dog, he didn't have the rich socialization of puppyhood. Everything in the world was way too exciting for poor Mocha. But gradually, with patience, Mocha learned to lie down. He would fling himself at my foot and lie on it, wagging furiously, just to get praise for lying down. Mocha learned that lying across the room didn't work either, because since I'm blind, I couldn't see him lying down across the room. So he thought down meant gallop over to your master's foot and lie on it. Since he wasn't a guide dog and he wasn't destined for obedience trials, nobody cared how he lay down, just that he did it. Unfortunately, I didn't know about clicker training at the time I had Mocha. Otherwise, I probably could have taught him many precise behaviors. But he loved making physical contact with me. And that's the clue. If you are a blind handler adopting a pet, pick something that likes being near you. If you can touch that dog, you can tell what it's up to. If you are lucky enough to start with a puppy and you never correct it, the dog will trust you completely. It will trust your voice and the touch of your hands, everything about you. And yes, people do raise well-behaved pets without aversives. Training classes, websites, and books are available to guide you. The trick is to treat for what you want. And to think about what you want. Instead of thinking, well, I don't want that dog on the sofa, think, I want that dog lying quietly beside the sofa. So as the dog charges toward your sofa, you click and treat any paws you can find. Soon, pausing before leaping on that sofa will be routine. Clicking longer pauses happens then only. This successive approximation is what also distinguishes clicker training from traditional training. In traditional training, the dog experimentally hops on the sofa and gets scolded. In clicker training, the dog jumps on the couch and is ignored. But as he sits by the sofa, he gets praised. So he learns that staying off the couch gives him more attention. You might be thinking that this is all well and good for pets. But what about piddling in the middle of the floor? And what about guide dogs? Suppose they rush out in front of oncoming traffic. How do you prevent all these consequences without punishment? This is where I stipulate that I'm a novice. I have avoided correction and housebreaking by simply taking dogs out on regular schedules and feeding them at regular intervals. But I haven't managed to raise a pet with zero corrections. And when we are in a squirrel-infested area, Boston still has to wear a pinch collar. But my goal is to be able to never use a pinch collar eventually. I don't, for example, bother with a pinch collar now when we shop at Walmart. And I don't reach reflexively to correct each time I need my dog's attention. A pure clicker trainer would probably say that I needed to abandon aversives entirely in order to be a clicker trainer. And, well, I agree wholeheartedly, but I'm a beginner. You have to walk before you run. If you wanted to go cold turkey and never issue another correction in your whole life, you'd need to work with a real professional. Unless, of course, you simply experimented with something you adopted from a shelter. And in experimenting, I'm talking about this in a positive sense, a guide dog has your safety in its paws, whereas Fluffy, from the animal shelter, might be perfect for experimenting, because any mistakes you make really don't matter. I mean, what happens if you click at the wrong moment with Fluffy? Who cares? If I weren't working full-time, I'd adopt and raise an all-clicker-trained dog from puppyhood in order to learn how to do it correctly. But unfortunately, I don't have the time right now to do that. Traditional jerk and praise has a lot of appeal because it does work. To avoid the correction, the dog learns to heel, but it's like you're doing your job to avoid being yelled at by your boss. Many trainers argue that traditional training erodes the dog's self-confidence. A lot more is available on that on the web if you're interested. In traditional training, it's also all about making the dog respect you, making the dog do something. In clicker training, the dog actually assumes more responsibility for his self-control because he is making himself behave in spite of distractions. Guide and service dog schools have shied away from clicker training, in my opinion, because it's much easier to train the jerk and praise method. But it's also my opinion that the bonding with your dog can be deeper if you take the road less traveled and work harder at it, but use fewer corrections. I'm going to emphasize this point again just because it's very important to me. In traditional training, you force the puppy into a down and you correct him if he fails to assume the position. He learns to see praise as a safety cue, that he's avoided punishment, at least this time. In clicker training, you lure the puppy into a down with food, or you shape him by reward him for lying down on his own. But either way, he starts to think that he's training you when he lies down. His confidence increases because he's training you. His ability to problem solve increases because he's not threatened by the chance to experiment. Traditional training is about correcting mistakes with punishment, but clicker training has you examine much more deeply what you want from your dog. If you create a digging box in your yard and you click your dog for excavating there, then your dog will avoid digging in your lawn, but he will still have the pleasure of digging. I often have a cartoon running through my head where mom is screaming at the toddler to behave himself, and the toddler is thinking, I am behaving like a little kid, and you're behaving like a screaming mom. It helps me to remember that all behavior is just that, behavior, and that training is our attempt to shape behavior so both the trainer and the trainee can feel more secure. One of my cyber friends did not want her dog jumping on the couch and barking wildly out of the window. So, when he did it, she dashed into the room, told him happily that she had a surprise for him, dragged him off to the bedroom, closed the door where she left the dog alone for 5 minutes. This indeed is a mild aversive, but it was more effective than shouting and leash correcting. Dogs hate being alone, so 5 minutes was plenty. It only took her a week and he stopped barking. She also taught him to speak so they could go bark together for fun sometimes, barking when she wanted and not when he wanted it. If you were to scoop up a little dog and scold it when it started yapping, well, it's a lap dog. It liked to be held. It would quickly learn to yap, so you would hold it. If you pet a dog for jumping up, it will quickly learn to jump. If you play with a dog when it barks, and this is our current problem with Boston, it will bark wildly to get you to play with it. But you can turn off the reward faucet. In so many instances, it's not only more humane than punishment, it is also more effective. Clicker training gives you another kind of freedom I wish to explore as we discuss some advanced methods. It allows and even encourages successive approximation. So Boston now assumes a bus sit after about 8 seconds when I snap, but I want a bus sit to happen in 5 seconds. And I want precision. I want his butt centered between my heels. To do this, I'll go back to rewarding with treats, but only if he sits within 5 seconds. You work on each criteria separately. So after I accomplish the 5 second sit, only then would I insist that his butt be centered. As it is now, his butt sit is consistent, but it is slow and sloppy. But I needn't correct him to improve things. I can keep refining the behavior until it is as rapid and as precise as I like. Take, for example, heel. You start by clicking anything that vaguely resembles heel. A bouncy dog bounces a bit less. An older dog pulls a bit less hard. And eventually, an older dog may move closer to you and lunges a little less at the end of its leash. Either way, you gradually tighten up your criteria. You click only until pretty soon you have a dog walking in perfect heeling position. But you have to work on this every day, and you have to tighten up your criteria very slowly. There is a technique called the 300-peck pigeon method that teaches persistence. Behaviorists taught pigeons to peck 300 times before receiving a treat. They started with one step, and then two, and then five. You can do the same. Start with one step, two, five, ten, and then you can teach a dog not to pull on leash for 300 steps, too. But it does take time. Boston heels perfectly now when I use a cane, but he still pulls hard when another person is guiding me. But then, if I were perfect, I could quit my job and hire myself out as a dog trainer, too. So don't let your inability to handle your dog perfectly discourage you from trying at all. I can't handle my dog perfectly, but I try to do something with him every day. Let's talk about the concept of timing. It is the split-second timing of the click that cues your dog that he's done the right thing. You teach shake hands and click when his paw is placed in your hand. Sighted people are told to practice their timing by clicking each time a bouncing ball hits the floor, each time a TV newscaster moves his hand to the right. But blind people can listen to a newscast and click every time they hear the word the, or they can click every time they hear any preposition. That's timing practice. You could click when listening to a performance and click every time you hear an audience member sneeze or sniffle or whatever. In meetings under the table, I make a little clicking movement with my finger each time I hear somebody say, Your dog's success depends on your timing, but blindness is no barrier to improving it. Another objection I've heard is that blind people cannot monitor at a distance. Well, that's true, but why should it be any objection any more than, say, the problem that a sighted person can't monitor a dog in another room? You will have to think out of the box here and use techniques that work for you, but I have taught Boston to come off leash, and I'm now working on having him speed it up a bit. I have a bell attached to his collar. I've also taught him to do a stay off-leash at a distance, though right now we're working on duration, that is, getting him to stay for longer periods. I require that he lie down on a stay and not move, so I can clearly monitor if he rings his bell. Also remember that sighted people may want their dogs to do things that you don't need your dogs to do, like lying down across the room. I don't care if my dog lies across the room. I want him to come and lay down on my foot. I don't need a dog to bring me the cordless phone, but I do need a dog who won't run off when I call. You can train a lot of fun things. People have trained their cats to follow coffee spoons around the table or to simply assume cute positions on command. I'm teaching Boston to retrieve a frisbee and to assume various body positions based on hand signals. He can't really do these things yet, but we're working on it. People train dogs to touch various parts of their body, such as put a head on their left knee or put a paw on their right foot. I've taken Boston's love for jumping and redirected it so he leaps in the air to slurp my fist without getting muddy paws on my clothing. I've taught him to spin in circles, to bark on command, to hand me his foot, and to come when I whistle. I would also like to teach him to make cute, soft noises when I request them, and to do search and rescue in parks for abandoned tennis balls, and to stay for really long periods of time off leash. Many people will see this stuff as silly tricks. Well, they are silly tricks. The idea is to bond and have fun doing it. It is also fun to have a pet that's easy and a pleasure to control. There is this belief that you must correct a dog to teach it to respect you. It helped me to realize that this, like most opinions, is a belief. It is not a fact. I recently attended a lecture by Ian Dunbar, who is a noted authority in this field, and he still uses corrections in extreme situations. A dog is about to run out into a busy street, and he scares it so bad that it doesn't go near that street again. But he won't correct if a dog simply tries to push ahead of him out of a doorway. Instead, he'll refuse to take that dog outside, ever, until it's moving out of the door behind him. No force will be necessary, because if the dog tries to forge ahead, the door will simply be closed in its face. When Boston is guiding and suddenly gets interested in a squirrel, I used to correct reflexively. Now I just stop. I know that he loves working, so usually the fact that we aren't moving is enough to redirect him. In the rare instances that it isn't, I still have to correct, and maybe I will be skilled enough with my next dog that I won't ever have to correct. That's my hope. But it's not my reality now. There are a few tools that make clicking easier. I love the treat pouches that now stay closed. They do this with their because their opening is spring-loaded. If you aren't reaching inside the pouch, they aren't open. You wear these like fanny packs, leaving your hands free. Also, for freeing your hands are the new hands-free leashes on the market. I like them especially for shopping because the leash has a built-in belt. When I drop the harness, I know Boston stays tethered to me and my two hands are available for operating the ATM or examining merchandise in the store. I also find the hands-free leash is the best tool for keeping excitable Boston calm. After bouncing about a bit, he usually settles into a down at my feet because the leash itself prevents him from moving far away. Even clickers don't need to take up your free hand. Mine has a springy wristband, so I wear it like a watch, with it dangling between my two fingers. I can grab it and click it even when that hand is full. My last tool is a flat collar, which Boston wears at all times. This means he's never getting pressure on his neck, never getting used to a collar tightening up. It means that the few corrections I still give him are very effective. If you are a traditionalist, you might be complaining that these newfangled techniques teach people to bribe dogs. But bribe has a negative connotation that is wholly undeserved. Are employers bribing us with paychecks? Do we bribe our politicians for votes? We need some way to manipulate our dogs to live safely in our world, and it's more fun to click than to punish. Another pervasive myth is this idea that you can't control your dog if you don't have food. Only someone who hasn't given clicker training a try would espouse this myth. Because food is a teaching tool, as I said before, Boston guides me safely up and down stairs every day without needing food, but he never knows when I might pull out a little treat. If he starts to rush a flight of stairs, I might treat a bit more to teach him to slow down and to pay attention. But once he's got that behavior, he might simply be rewarded by praise or a special toy if he navigates an uneven flight particularly carefully. Even clicker-trained chickens learn to work with random food reinforcers, and since the desire to please is much stronger in dogs, you can find many other ways to reinforce desired behavior. So I hope we've debunked those myths about bribing and food. You might ask, if clicker training is so great, why hasn't it been used for guide and service dog work? Well, many schools are changing slowly, and I can only guess at this. But I think traditional training is easier to teach. It's more robotic. You don't have to think about your dog as an individual personality. If he's good, you praise. If he's bad, you jerk. It has fewer rules. Not every guide dog user is really a dog person or wants to be. So I think the schools can teach average people with a few rules, and they can go out and manage mostly successfully with their guide dogs. But I am not average. Actually, I'm a lot like my dog. I'm a questioner. I'm an explorer. I'm a seeker of truth, if you will. I would like to think that I can apply the golden rule even when it comes to handling a golden retriever. There is still this pack leader business, the idea that you must correct to get respect. This assumes that the dog is basically waiting around for chances to defy you, when most dogs are simply trying out new behaviors to see what might get them better rewards. Dogs inherently try out new things in order to get the best deal in life. So do we, in fact, and we call this strategy intelligence. But we humans seem hell-bent on crippling our dog's intelligence by punishment and punishing his attempts to experiment. Traditional training is based on the dominance model of pack behavior. Zoologists proposed this model after studying wolf packs. We've all heard about how we need to be the alpha and show the dog who is boss. But more recent theories are contradicting this whole dominance paradigm, which itself is also only a theory after all. The dominance model is being reconsidered as modern ethologists are coming to believe that our dogs descended not from wolves, but from loosely knit packs of jackal-like creatures. Early village dog packs scavenged together, but it is now theorized they didn't have a fixed leader. They didn't engage in the structured, cooperative hunting of wolves. So perhaps our dogs, if they were indeed descended from loosely organized packs of village scavengers, do not actually look for a domineering leader. If that's the case, there's really no excuse for excessive correction. And of course, you can still be in charge. After all, you decide when they go out, when they get treats, and what treats they get. I decide when to surprise Boston by pulling out a squeaky toy or opening my purse to give him a dog cookie. I am, of course, in charge, and my dogs have never questioned that, but I don't have to dominate to lead. Correcting for me is no longer a knee-jerk reaction to every doggy misdeed. Instead, I analyze why my dog isn't behaving the way I want, and I work hard toward shaping his behavior more to my liking.